Good evening. Welcome. There's a couple of seats over on the side. Here's a couple of seats. So, last Wednesday, Reverend Dana gave a talk about practicing Zen in the 21st century. So I thought I'd continue with that theme. I think by 21st century we mean this particular century as compared to earlier ones. Often we feel like, I think these days I hear many people say, this is, you know, unprecedented happenings in this world and there's never been a time like this, and I think this is true in many ways. But also I wanted to find out more about how things were in previous centuries too, especially in terms of Dharma practice, because that's what we're talking about, do we need a new kind of practice for the 21st century? So just for my own curiosity, I tried to research a little bit. And, you know, there's experts in all these things, so this was small research. I don't know that much history, but I tried to research a little bit of what was it like in India in the 5th century B.C. when the Buddha lived. How were things? And I think there's probably a lot we don't know, but amazingly, there's a lot we do know, particularly about northern India at that time, because these Buddhist texts were first orally transmitted and then written down. And, you know, thousands and thousands of pages and very detailed descriptions of course, the practice, but also how life was at that time. They were pretty good record keepers. And so some of what we know, according to these very old texts about 5th century B.C., India, is that there was this caste system, as there still is today in India. Amazingly long-standing human institution. And at that time there was great discrepancy between the upper castes, like the Brahmin caste, and there was the Chandala, the untouchable caste in Buddha's time. And the caste system, one is born into a certain caste, it's hereditary, and you can't, like, it's not upwardly mobile kind of thing. You can't move up through the castes. It's your lot for life. And for the upper caste, this worked very nicely as a kind of political setup to get all the menial work done for nothing. So huge kind of lifestyle differences between the rich and the poor. And also, this I didn't know till I started researching, but there was slavery in India in Buddha's time. So in some ways I think the caste system is somewhat similar to even modern America in the 21st century, except that we have more flexibility of changing. Some might feel not enough flexibility. There's political setups that prevent that. But this is, you know, compared to the hereditary thing, I think we have great improvements over that system. And though we've had slavery in this country somewhat recently, There's not official licensed legal slavery in the mainstream. And also in terms of violence in the Buddha's time, different like kind of states in India would attack each other regularly. There were battles and people were killed, often over territory and property and so on. And apparently some new kind of high-tech weapons were first designed and built kind of around the time of Buddha in India. They were into that kind of stuff. Iron was a new thing, and iron was mainly used for weapons. Definitely violence and political oppression and prejudice against the lower castes, where people were kind of trapped, and slavery. And we know from actually the Buddha's sutras, because the Buddha knew some of these people, so it was probably probably many, many examples. Since the Buddha just lived in a certain area and knew some of these people, it was probably much more, it's probably an example that there was much more going on. But King Ajatasattru, during the Buddha's lifetime, killed his father, the King Bimbisara, first imprisoned him. I think he died in prison so that he could usurp the throne. Bimbisara was a devoted follower of the Buddha. So these two characters were woven into various interactions and stories of the Buddha. So there was murdering one's own father for these political and power reasons. There was the serial killer Angulimala. This, the whole sutra is devoted to mass murderer, serial killer, kind of crazy. He had some crazy ideas, and he had to kill 100 people was his mission. And Angulimala means like a mala, like a string of beads made out of fingers. He would keep a finger from each person he killed and wear them. And the Buddha was going to be the 100th. So a serial killer who actually killed 99 people, according to this story. And Buddha was able to kind of stop him and convert him to peacefulness. So there were probably others that we don't know about too. I doubt it was the only one in India happened to come across the Buddha. So nowadays we have serial killers. It's very rare that people in kind of a one-by-one kind of way can reach 99 people before getting arrested and discovered. We can imagine that in those days they were they didn't have the internet, so it's harder to track people down. People all knew about Angulimala, but they couldn't catch him. And So in some ways it seems there were many more problems than modern times in 5th century India. Not to mention, of course, much shorter lifespan due to disease and before the discovery of many of modern medicine and surgery and so on. Many of the same social issues, I would say, were happening there, except it seems like a little bit worse. And the Buddha, how did the Buddha respond to this? This is kind of my question. Because if the question is, how do we respond to these kind of situations in the 21st century? It seems like, well, maybe the situation was in many ways worse. I think there's some ways that it may be worse now. I think especially the biggest change now, biggest changes maybe we could see now are climate change is huge. That really wasn't an issue then. And partly the climate change is due to overpopulation. The amount of people on the planet was a tiny, tiny fraction of what it is now. So of course those two go together. And of course we have more high-tech weapons, but we also have, because we have more communication now, there's some, it's a little bit less like spontaneous, ruthless, direct attacking, at least of like the US. It happens, right? But there's, we're able to meet with people, leaders of other countries and so on. I think also one thing that seems to have changed all around the world through the centuries is women's rights. Sometimes that's mentioned as something that has really improved in the 21st century. Of course there's problems, it can get better, but if we compare to ancient times, still, like women's rights in India are nothing like the US. And so the Buddha's response to all this was, for one thing, regarding the caste system, he allowed all the castes to join the Sangha of monks kind of indiscriminately. And as I understand it, that was kind of a radical thing in his time. And so I don't think he was trying to recruit the lower castes. He was just open to anybody coming, and anybody could practice and realize the Dharma. And they were welcome, and they did. I think one of these history reports I was reading said it took a little while. The first people to join the Sangha for a while during the Buddha's lifetime were the upper caste, because Buddha was from the Kshatriya warrior caste, the kind of upper caste. So it's mostly those people that knew him, but gradually, over the course of Buddha's 80-year lifetime, the lower castes started joining, because they were welcome to. And there were no special exceptions, they weren't given the menial jobs, because they were the lower caste, but they also weren't given like special dispensation and sort of a break. It was more like everybody's just equal and welcome, and everyone follows the same precepts, and there's some hierarchy based on seniority in the Sangha, but not based on caste. So that was one of Buddha's, I don't know if it's actually political response, but it was just, I think he wasn't thinking of it as like, let's change the caste system. I imagine that Buddha was thinking, well, we just have this open practice and anybody can do it. And the practice doesn't apply to castes. Whereas some religion before the Buddha, like the Brahmins, only the Brahmin caste could be priests. So now it's quite different for the Buddha. And also, regarding women, many people have heard the story of our first woman ancestor, Mahaprajapati, who had to kind of like push Buddha a little bit to have the women get admitted into the monastic sangha. It may be that that was partly because, again, it was a radical new idea. There were these homeless, wandering ascetics. I don't think there were many women before the Buddhist time doing that kind of lifestyle. There were probably some. But again, the way that the Buddha was convinced with the pushing of Ananda on behalf of Mahaprajapati was to ask the Buddha, like, well, can women realize awakening? And the Buddha said, yeah, of course. And so, well, then, of course, they can practice like this. So that was kind of a social change of religion at that time. But as far as the Buddha, of course, as I mentioned, the Buddha happens to be friends with King Bimbisara, so he was able to talk to him a little bit about government. This was not like king of India. This was like, these were kings of smaller areas. And generally when he would advise the king about things, it wasn't so much like political moves. It was just mostly about virtue. Just practice kindness and compassion and take care of your people. Kind of obvious. And that teaching of virtue was offered to everybody, the lay people and the monastics. And in some ways the monastics couldn't really be involved in politics. Their job was to just practice meditation full time, realize understanding so that they could transmit it to others, to lay people and monastics. So it's hard to know if Shakyamuni Buddha suddenly appeared in California today, would he teach in a completely different way? We have no way to know, but if we look at these conditions in India, it's so different, so long ago, it's a different culture, and yet these issues, similar issues, except things were maybe a little bit worse then. And so Buddha might teach pretty much the same way. If people want to really get into practice, do a lot of meditation, live a simple life, be kind to others, and it wasn't so much trying to fix society. Except, you might say, it's sort of maybe secretly or without trying to fix society. Society would get gradually transformed by so many practitioners practicing kindness and compassion and opening to selflessness and the realization of non-separation. And of course, during Buddha's life, it was a mass movement. Many, many people kind of picked up on that practice and just did the practice. So if we're in accord with this example, we might say Zen practice for the 21st century might be like kind of similar. We just do the practice of precepts, kindness, meditation, compassion, taking care of what's in front of us and the people having difficulty in front of us and being open and having a sangha that's open to everybody to come. So that was one kind of little research part of it. I would say my main, if I had to pick two heroes, life heroes, Shakyamuni Buddha, he's a hero, and Dogen Zenji in Japan. So the Buddha founded our whole tradition in India, Buddha Dharma, and bringing Zen to Japan. Dogen was a kind of innovator, and definitely his way of presenting practice and teaching was kind of new. Buddhism was well established in Japan when Dogen came. But looking a little bit at the history of this Kamakura period in Japan, it was the 13th century. It seems like in Japanese history, this was kind of a particularly politically tumultuous time, the Kamakura period. Again, there were very, very wealthy court aristocracy and nobility, government, that was like, it was this height of kind of like aesthetic appreciation and these magnificent temples and palaces, and the arts were flourishing amongst the aristocracy. And then there was this huge discrepancy with all these peasants struggling to survive. And the accounts I read was the aristocracy didn't care so much about the peasants. They really tried to ignore them and live in their own sort of pure world of arts and so on. Again, I think some similarities to 21st century. But reading these descriptions to me, again, it sounded worse than our modern culture. that discrepancy was worse, and the kind of blatant ignorance and the kind of just resistance. Again, I think in modern times, the poor at least have some voice to speak out, and again, through media and so on, and petitioning, and well, again, we have a long way to go here, but I think at those times there was just no voice. If you speak out, you're arrested, and then there was this, a lot of struggle for power in the government, the samurai warriors were forming and trying to take over the government at different times, and this one history of Kamakura time said later samurai became kind of like more considered more noble, and maybe this is like maybe in the movies samurai, like this, like these qualities, very loyal to their lords, right? They'll like do anything for their masters. That's kind of the our modern image of samurai, and apparently that was true, but that came later. In this early phase of Kamakura samurai, they were just like ruthless killers, and they were just kind of conniving and ruthless, and they didn't have the sense of loyalty. It was just like, take power, and any lives that will be lost along the way, fine. And similarly, women, the situation was very different. The royalty could buy women to live in the palace. And even in the temples, so Buddhism, again, had been established for many centuries already. Buddhism was like the national religion, and the Buddhist temples became very powerful and had a lot of land and property and wealth. And we had, particularly where Dogen lived, Mount Hiei was the Tendai school headquarters, and is still there on Mount Hiei, a huge temple complex. And at that time, in order to maintain their holdings, this is the only time I've heard of this in Buddhist history, but there were these warrior monks, like there was an army of armed monks at Hiei-zanba, not only the Tendai school, but other schools apparently. Zen hadn't come yet. Dogen was at the beginning of Zen, but other Buddhist Mahayana traditions had these monastic armies. They carried arms and they would kill people if they needed to defend their territory. And they'd sometimes attack other temples and other schools to kind of gain their property and take their temples. And so, wow. This is the Buddhism that Dogen was born into in Japan. So, again, we might be like, well, compared to Dogen's time, we have it rough in the 21st century. I think we maybe have different problems, but I think some of the basic ones, again, violence and war. There was civil war going during Dogen's life. There was the Jokyo War. It was a civil war in the small country of Japan during Dogen's lifetime. So war, violence, great discrepancy between the rich and the poor with no way to address it. And prejudice against, if not races, against different castes and women. So it looks to me like when we compare to these times, it is greatly improved. But I imagine that people at any time when they're alive in the world probably feel like it's the most intense, radical time ever. I think it's just natural. We hear what's going on and we think, this is like crazy what's going on. And in the past, we didn't know the history so much. And in the present, maybe we don't look into the distant history so much. But Also, does anyone know this Steven Pinker? Is an author and a Harvard professor. And one of his specialties seems like, yeah, I think he's just written or is writing a book on this kind of progression of history, and particularly studying violence. Violence being like murder, war, and battles and things like this. Death by violence, violent death, and how has that gone? And he looked at this, and this is, you know, just on the web, and I didn't spend that much time with this. There may be other studies that show different things, but it seemed very well documented across many, many different countries through the centuries. It was graphs, and it's showing steadily from way back before the Buddha's time, death by violence is, just way progressively, century by century, down, way down. Like, there was one study that was like the, a little before the Buddha's time, a few centuries before the Buddha in India. It was, one study showed that maybe up to 30% of deaths were due to murder or war. Like, killed, in other words, 30% of people who died were killed by other people. And now, worldwide, it's like less than 1%. It's, you know, a tiny, tiny fraction. So Steven Pinker says, violence has been in decline over long stretches of time, and we may be living in the most peaceful time in our species' existence. I think it's just good to get a bigger picture, right? Of course there's great violence going on right now. Of course there's murder, there's war, there's oppression of the poor and racism and rape. Yeah, it's been going on from way back, right, all the way through. I didn't see particular figures on that particular issue, but I imagine that it's probably less in this country than it was in a millennia ago, because I think just law has become more sophisticated. Of course, it still happens way more than we would like it to, but I think in the past there were, you know, people could get away with a lot and never, you know, they were sort of outside the law. And still there's countries where it's like that, and we might say in the U.S. it's, people can try to get outside the law, but it's hard. Of course it happens, but, not to try to paint a really just pretty picture of like, there's no problem anymore, but it's, I think it's interesting. It puts things in perspective to see that, like, we have a lot of problems, we should keep working on them, but it's much, things have improved a lot in many different ways, except for climate change. That one has not improved, and the population that's affecting climate change. But mainly, this research was to see how did my heroes, these great Buddhas and ancestors, how did they practice in, you know, political and tumultuous conditions worse than ours? Did they say, we should stop meditating and go out on the streets and protest the government? Seems like there's no records of anybody doing that, actually. Maybe sometimes the religious people got criticized for not doing more. I don't know. I haven't seen that in the records. But I think we could say Buddhism and other religions too, they're traditionally over the millennia, their main way to affect change, especially Buddhism, maybe some other religions have gotten a little bit more politically involved and conquering and so on. But I think the heart of all religions is to actually to change people in society, but kind of like in a way one at a time, through ourselves, through the ethical precepts which all religions have, through kindness and compassion, and through deeper understanding of our non-separation and unity, and the love, the big love that that binds us together in this life. And it, I know we need that. We need it now, and we needed it then, and so maybe it's not that Buddhism needs to like radically change in the 21st century. At least that's kind of like my take on it. I think we could say it needs to get deeper, and particularly this issue of climate change, we might say, we're really at the point now where we might, the species, actually, of humanity, there's never been a time in history when it's like, humanity might not make it, right? So many people are saying now, and wherever we are in denying how imminent all this is, on the spectrum, we know it's big. I think probably all of us, at least in this room, know that this is major and unprecedented. I heard how many climate deniers does it take to change a light bulb?
I don't know. How many?
Zero. Because there's not enough information yet on whether the light bulb needs to be changed. So, thinking about climate change, it's interesting to look at Buddhism and other spiritual traditions kind of historically and classically. So, some of these teachings are from this book that Nettie mentioned 2 weeks ago, Eco Dharma by David Loy. He brings up some interesting points about Buddhism and religion in general. He has this term that somebody coined called cosmological dualism, I think it's called. Cosmological duality. And this is basically the teaching that there's a kind of a transcendent realm other than our just, you know, present human life on Earth. And it seems like most, he says all the major religions, including Buddhism, have some form of this cosmological dualism, which means like there's this, our life as it appears on Earth here, and then there's a transcendent realm that often, again, through almost all religions, has to do with what happens after we die. There's that. That's our real transcendent home is after we leave this, messed up human world, whether it's an eternal heaven or whether it's the potential of parinirvana, where there's no more rebirth into this world. So a parinirvana that's completely separated from the cycle of samsara, living in this messy world, was early Buddhism, really, I think, clearly has this cosmological dualism. The goal of the practice is to realize this nirvana, which means you're no longer born into this world of suffering. And as we heard, there was more suffering then. I think that's one clue. We could say another maybe clue that things are going better now, at least in America, California Dharma, is that in the old days in India, almost everyone was on board with, we do not want to be born into this world again. That was like, people didn't have to be convinced of that. This is a suffering life, and we don't want to come back. Therefore, most religion, not just Buddhism, other Indian religions, that was the goal. We're going to leave this realm and not come back. And I think most people you talk to in modern America were like, Would you like to be reborn? Most people say, yeah, definitely. What about not coming back? What? I want to come back and live in Santa Cruz. Father, we don't forget that the Buddha teaches you might come back as a slug in Santa Cruz, a banana slug for thousands of lifetimes and get run over by cars in each one of them. But, you know, I think it's interesting, right? I think most people that you ask in modern Buddhism, even whether most people actually probably don't believe in the rebirth thing, or many don't. But if you did, if there were such a thing, would you like to sign on for another round? Definitely sign me up. I think that says something about how the conditions are so much better. Anyway, that cosmological dualism is maybe not necessarily such a problem for social interactions. It could be, but I think for environmental interactions, for climate change, it could be a major problem, right? Because it's like we're just going to let this world's going to go anyway, so we'll all meet in the Dharmakaya. In early Buddhism, it's the parinirvana, and clearly separate from samsara. In the Mahayana, maybe people already started seeing some flaws with that goal, and like it's too escapism and it's too dualistic. So in the Mahayana, we start hearing teachings like samsara and nirvana are not the slightest bit different. Like Nagarjuna teaches this. And of course, these are really profound teachings. It's hard to understand what they mean. And I would say that, and David Loy says, there still can be a cosmological dualism in this, and even to say that samsara and nirvana are not the slightest bit different, because realizing nirvana is realizing the kind of the essence of samsara, the true nature of samsara is totally free and beyond suffering. And that really is different than being in samsara and not realizing this and being just bound up and caught up in the suffering. So you could still see that as a kind of duality, right? Even though samsara and nirvana truly are not the slightest bit different, you still have to realize this to kind of transcend the suffering of samsara. So then it might even be like you're in the world and the world's falling apart, but it's okay because it's not as real as the emptiness of it, right? Emptiness would be like, instead of the eternal heaven or the parinirvana after you die, emptiness is kind of a transcendent reality beyond the suffering world. So that's where, as the Mahayana evolves more and more towards non-duality, in the Zen tradition is maybe as far as it goes, as far as I can tell looking into different Buddhist traditions, the tradition that most emphasized the ordinary life in the world itself as the transcendent freedom. Based on these teachings of samsara and nirvana are not two. It's that same basis, but instead of saying, yes, samsara and nirvana are not two, but when we really realize this nirvana, we maybe won't really care about things like chopping wood and carrying water. But in Zen, they famously say, Laimen Pong, a great Tang Dynasty Chinese Zen adept, said, I forget the poem exactly, but it's something like, what is the true functioning of all the Buddhas and their complete enlightenment? It's just chopping wood and carrying water. So you enact this transcendent reality by the particulars of how we're living in the world. Maybe that was really there through all the Mahayana, but in Zen it really got emphasized of like, we're taking care of the particular details of this world. You know, the great Tibetan adept Padmasambhava in the 8th century famously said, my view and my understanding is vaster than the sky, but my conduct is finer than barley flour. You know, it's these two go together. Everything is completely beyond what we usually think it is. Reality is boundless and vast. But the way I take care of things is like each you know, flower particle of barley I pay attention to. And like Dogen says, Dogen has an essay called Deep Trust in Cause and Effect near the end of his life. Dogen really emphasizing we have to pay attention to cause and effect. Everything that we do all day long through body, speech, and mind has an effect. And he taught everything is completely empty and ungraspable. And the way that that empty ungraspability appears is like when I do this, when I raise this finger, your eyebrows move, you know, like everything has an effect. And particularly in terms of our conduct and the way we take care of each other and harm each other in this world. So I think the tradition as it evolved, Buddhism, I think, consciously tried to address this cosmological dualism and did a pretty good job of it, I think. And so, but that's a danger in classic Buddhism, is cosmological dualism. And then David Loy, this modern author, mentions, so that's the classic Buddhism and its pitfalls. What about modern Western Buddhism? Which is, he says, I think rightly so, is mainly the popular version of kind of what we might call convert Buddhism or non-Asian Buddhism in America and Europe is largely based on the mindfulness movement. It's just exploded, right, in the last 5-10 years. Mindfulness-based stress reduction, Buddhism as mindfulness, kind of like stripping down the religion to its basics, and you know, we don't need so many rituals because we're really, mindfulness really addresses suffering, and I think we all know this. It really, when we pay attention to what we do, it really does reduce our suffering, and it's about, mindfulness is not at all about this transcendent realm, right? In that way, it's, there's some debate going on about, well, is the mindfulness movement and even this so-called secular Buddhism, is it actually still Buddhism if it's missing this transcendent goal of realizing emptiness or nirvana, which is kind of like the point of classic Buddhism? So these are, you know, I think it's a good conversation to keep having. And if it's not Buddhism, does that matter? Is it? It's helping people, right? It's helping people live their lives in this life, in this non-transcendent, you know, world that we live in. But David Loy, interesting, points out from a climate change perspective, we can see the transcendent dualism problem. But in the modern Buddhism, you might think this is great. But he says it looks completely opposite in many ways from classic Buddhism. The mindfulness movement that's about living in this life and relieving our personal suffering, instead of relieving our personal suffering through dying into the transcendent. But he said, they look really almost opposite, but in fact, they share this one thing, is that they're both really about kind of like personal liberation from suffering. And they both can neglect the world that we're living in. I think this is true. The modern mindfulness movement doesn't necessarily have a kind of ethical component. And I think there's some big places now functioning that are like mindfulness centers that are outside of Buddhism, but they're just maybe like very kind of like high-end, expensive to attend. Maybe that, you know, they're filled with like plastic stuff and so on. And they're people are going about their decadent, large, carbon footprint life, but their personal suffering is being relieved, and so they can go about a kind of kind of destructive lifestyle with more ease and comfort. So interesting, I think, to point these out. If there wasn't so much this environmental issue, maybe it would be okay, as long as we isn't such a discrepancy between the rich and poor. So this is maybe a question for Zen in the 21st century: is how do we not fall into either of these extremes of some transcendent goal that neglects the world where nirvana is somehow separate from samsara and emptiness is somehow separate from form? That's why we have to keep chanting the Heart Sutra every morning. That form itself is emptiness and emptiness itself is form. It's good medicine for the world, I think, to chant this. And we have to be careful that the kind of secular mindfulness movement doesn't turn into just like a mindless movement of taking care of our personal emotions, but actually neglecting this, our deep trust in cause and effect that Dogen praises, where everything we do has an effect. So particularly maybe all these issues is great, and I think American Buddhism is definitely working on racism and sexism and inequality and environmental issues, and we can do them more, and that's great. Hopefully not at the expense of our meditation and practice and deepening our understanding of reality. It's also sometimes when I think of these questions and practice in the 21st century, realistically, we all have limited time and energy. We have a limited lifespan so far. Maybe this century we'll discover a way to live to be 200 or 300, but so far it's kind of limited span, right? We can't do everything. So how are we going to use our energy? I think practice is a great benefit to ourselves and others, opening to our non-separation and developing kindness and compassion. And helping the world in practical ways. I think of one of our modern things, just even in the last 10 years, I think is this like, and this is a difference from the Buddha's and Dogen's time, is the media onslaught, right? We can and do spend huge percentages of time just trying to keep up with what's going on in this world. And I think it's really healthy that we can know more what's going on in the world. So if some country that's being oppressed, other countries can immediately step in to some extent. And this was not possible in the past. So I think that the connectedness of the internet has great, great benefits for reducing harm, actually. But also, it can have great destructive and distractive qualities, where, you know, if we can learn, I was asking Dana about this last week, because it's a question for me. I kind of feel like if I learn something through the news and the media where I can actually affect some change, I think that's so great. We can learn about all these issues. If I'm learning about something where I can't really do anything, then how much time and energy do I want to devote to it? And each of us will have to, you know, choose that amount. But every minute that we're on the news, we're not meditating. And every minute we're meditating, we're not watching the news. So realistically, our deep trust in cause and effect is just notice what we're doing. And are we consciously choosing to spend our time in a way, in this limited life, in a way that's hopefully helpful? So just one last thought about climate change, because I think it's such a major issue now, is in some ways I think addressing it in many ways ties in more, more closely to Buddhist practice than other issues. But I naturally, I think this, you know, the caste system example ties in very nicely. And even, you know, here that we're open to everybody of all classes and races and genders and so on. that openness is a natural expression of Dharma. And for climate change, I think it's a little bit different. It's paying attention to cause and effect, which is very complex with climate change. We have a climate change discussion group where we can learn about, I think really about cause and effect is what we're doing in that group. Just getting informed of this very complex web of interdependent arising and how human actions change the world in large ways. But I think as a practice, especially, it's watching our cause and effect. How we live, we all know this, is really affects the world. And I'm thinking of it these days is, you know, there's an Al Gore movie, right? Inconvenient Truth. It struck me recently that that title is like a, has a kind of meaning that I didn't really pick up on until recently, that this truth, the inconvenient truth, is climate change, right? It's inconvenient. It's maybe kind of, understating it, but maybe this is what he meant, but I just didn't really hit me so much. But it's inconvenient for us. Climate change is very inconvenient. And we might even attribute largely, mainly, we could say overpopulation is this particular issue, but in addition to that, maybe the main change of, main causality of climate change is we are really into convenience. Especially the first world countries in modern times, in the 21st century, we are way into convenience. And it's amazing how convenient things are compared to Dogen's and Buddha's time. And many convenient things are, I was going to say maybe okay, but as I start to think about it, I can't think of any examples of like new convenient technology that doesn't have a harmful impact on climate change. It's kind of scary. Maybe modern medicine, I think, is just a really amazing wonder of, it's sort of like convenience. But in fact, one effect of modern medicine is overpopulation. So, but so many things we do through the day are very convenient. We can flip a switch and the lights come on. But if we have deep trust in cause and effect, we can say, this, it's not just that the lights came on or you flip the switch. Something's like being used to do this. And I am very happy to know that I think it's all of Monterey County is, officially our power is all coming, our electricity is all coming from renewable power now. Meaning it's like we're buying that from, we're buying the renewable power through the grid. Of course, there's local non-renewable power sources, but economically we're supporting that way. So in some ways that's an example, like I kind of feel like maybe even inefficient, I think we're making bigger strides in electricity than fuel, cooking and heating fuel burning. So when we change to electricity, somebody can probably refute me on this, but I kind of felt like I would rather use an electric space heater, which is tends to be more inefficient than the fuel furnace, because the electric heater is now renewable power. One could probably argue different sides of this, but it's just trying to learn about these cause and effect. So and it's inconvenient. It's inconvenient to learn about it, and it's inconvenient to change. So I just recently saw this nice chart that was like, because a lot of this say personal lifestyle stuff doesn't make that much difference, but I think that's where the Buddhist practice part comes in. Of course, major political changes have to happen too. But on the personal lifestyle, this chart was low, medium, and high impact ranked by carbon production. So low impact is like upgrading your light bulbs to LED or compact fluorescent. These are great. We did it in the Zendo here. And that's a great example, I think, of to try to do everything. But it's very low impact. Moderate impact is like not using electric dryers on sunny days. So Shoho and I like to hang up our laundry. It's very inconvenient. It's, you know, you can just throw the stuff in the dryer, right? But that's a major electric use, right? And sometimes the sun, in the rain, it's one thing, but so it's, that's, on this chart, that's moderate carbon effect. Doing laundry with cold water instead of hot water, replacing a car with a standard car with hybrid, these were in moderate impact. And they're more inconvenient. High impact is, you know, an electric car instead of a hybrid car. You know, like Patrick and some others are, you know, but it's very inconvenient and expensive, right? Green energy, high impact. All of Santa Cruz now and Zen Center using renewable electricity. High impact climate change. Transportation's huge. Less driving, you know, more public transit, more biking and walking. One transatlantic flight, I am super guilty. I'm going to be more guilty of this in the future, is like eliminating one flight is like, you know, changing to an electric car. It's like major. And so one thing I like to do with flights and with all this use, you can calculate your carbon footprint on the web. A bunch of sites you can do this. Plug in your lifestyle data, get your carbon amount that you use in a year, and carbon offsets you can pay back. And it's amazingly, if these seem to be the, it's a pretty big thing going on now. The cost is not that high. Like it's like, for me, it's like $100. You know, maybe if you do a lot of flying and driving, it would be more. And you're basically, that's, this is, it's better to not produce it. But if you're going to produce it, this is, you're putting back, you're taking out the exact amount of carbon that you put in to the atmosphere in a year. I think it's pretty cool that it's possible. So the projects, they're like methane capture and so on that you're supporting. So, another high impact is, of course, plant-based diet. It's not low or medium, it's high impact. And the beauty of that one is it's like, it's a traditional Buddhist practice, coincidentally, in Mahayana, East Asian countries. So China, Korea, Japan, until recent times, for many centuries, were basically vegan due to the animal, not, you know, animal, all sentient beings have Buddha nature. So it's a Mahayana teaching. And so like in monastic life, but also lay life, people would do, if they weren't doing it all the time, they would, certain days, they would be vegetarian. And so that's one where it's maybe inconvenient. I guess I'm so used to it for so long, it doesn't feel so inconvenient, but if you're used to another way, it maybe is an inconvenient change. But I think what I feel is like the individual changes that have big impact on a larger scale are the most connected to practice. And, you know, we need other things too, but if we can kind of demonstrate a kind of contentment with a simpler life and patience with inconvenience practice helps us with, then it may help. So there's some thoughts on Zen practice in the 21st century. No conclusions really, but it's kind of late, but any brief comments or questions or rebuttals? Well, yes. Yeah, it wasn't my, of course, a lot could be done. It's interesting to learn history. But, yeah. You're welcome. Yes.
Did you find a difference between the Garjuna's time and the history there, and what was happening in that point in history in the Buddha and other points of history, where maybe that kind of philosophy of samsara and nirvana not being separate or different may have actually had an opportunity to be a little bit more inviting or attractive?
Yeah, I think that when the Mahayana, which that's one of the main teachings, is I think it kind of it really opened up Buddha Dharma, the Mahayana movement about non-duality of samsara and nirvana, and it made many more types of life could be considered practice. So it's like with this Mahayana movement was like maybe the time of Nagarjuna, about the time of Christ and a little bit after. Buddhism before that had been largely monastic, and the Mahayana came along with open up to the whole lay world, because practice, everything can be practice. So that was one of the implications of this understanding. And also compassion was always there in the early teachings, but with the birth of the Mahayana, this kind of universal compassion of like, we're all in this together, and we, no one can be totally free in an individual way without caring about the freedom from suffering for all beings, because we're really not separate. I think that compassion kind of exploded in this huge new way, and just the vastness of the vision, really took off. Yeah. So let's continue to practice in the 21st century and find our way together. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I